with Curtis Lewa.
Two young people decided to form their own organization called the Guardian Angels. You see them with red berets. When you see them, you get a nice, secure feeling in your heart.
I admire Curtis Lewa, and I think that he takes his life into his own hands doing what he does.
Curtis Lewa, the Guardian Angels founder and leader.
We've got Curtis Lewa from WABC Radio.
Curtis Lewa, legendary New York.
The Drive at 5 with Curtis Lewa. What happened today, why, and what's next? Live, local, on it, 77 WABC.
Oh, love that. Love that Ken Duffy update. Carmelo Anthony, number 7, going, just about gone to the Houston Rockets. Remember when it was number 17, Lou? Remember of the Knicks when all of a sudden Carmelo decided he couldn't share it any longer with Lou and decided, hey, he had to pack up, or Carmelo Anthony was packing up. But I can't believe I am so happy that Carmelo Anthony will be out of this place. As we're high atop Madison Square Garden, the great facilities provided to us by NJ.com for this for this 50,000 powerful watts of sound that's coming to all of you. And I got to explain for a second before we go to our guest, Jeffrey Lord, that my oldest son is a sycophantody and lackey. That's right, a sycophantody and lackey of Carmelo Anthony. Even in his email address, he has the name Carmelo Anthony. You go into his room, and it's a shrine to Carmelo Anthony. It's the biggest chucker in the history of the New York Knicks since Howie Komaes used to chuck from 30 feet out in the days when Walter Bellamy was the center, Van Arsdale brothers were at the forwards. I know that's old school, but I couldn't be more fatuts. I couldn't be happier to get that Carmelo Anthony out of the house of Madison Square Garden. I hope it's true. It's true. Meantime, I know there are Clintonistas galore who are hoping that one day Jeffrey Lord gets the pink slip at CNN, because sometimes he is the lone valiant one to defend Donald Trump against all attacks, and they come fast, furiously, and viciously at you, Jeff. You know, if ever the day that CNN says to you, hey, hang it up, Jeffrey, there's going to be a standing ovation of all the Clintonistas out there. You know that, don't you, Jeffrey?
Parties all over America, to which I will not be invited.
Now, I want to sort of have you listen in to the confirmation hearing today of Christopher Wray to replace James Comey as the next FBI director. When the question came from Senator Lindsey Graham of South Carolina, and basically he was talking about what Donald Trump Jr. has just been accused of doing.
Should Donald Trump Jr. have taken that meeting?
Well, Senator, I'm hearing for the first time your description of it, so I'm not really in a position to speak to it. I gather that Special Counsel Mueller
would... Well, let me ask you this. If I got a call from somebody saying the Russian government wants to help Lindsey Graham get reelected, they've got dirt on Lindsey Graham's opponent, should I take that meeting?
Well, Senator, I would think you'd want to consult with some good legal advisors before you did that.
So the answer is, should I call the FBI?
I think it would be wise to let the FBI
know. You're going to be the director of the FBI, pal. So here's what I want you to tell every politician. If you get a call from somebody suggesting that a foreign government wants to help you by disparaging your opponent, tell us all to call the FBI.
To the members of this committee, any threat or effort to interfere with our elections from any nation state or any non-state actor is the kind of thing the FBI would want to know.
All right, so I'll take that we should call you, and that's a great answer.
Jeffrey, that's something that Donald Trump Jr. nor Kushner nor Manafort did, right? Right?
Thought for Senator Graham is that I guess he's now going to report his friend John McCain to the FBI for getting that dossier from a non-state actor who was actually from another country. And I guess he's going to report his fellow senator and his friend for this. Look, I've been in presidential campaigns. I've been in other campaigns. You get asked all of the time to meet with people, with all kinds of people, good, bad, and indifferent. There hasn't been a campaign ever, I don't think, that was told, hey, we've got some info on your opponent, we'd like to talk to you, who hasn't said, okay, I'll go talk to you. He didn't do anything. He didn't do anything other than take a 20-minute meeting, and he didn't get anything. And the meeting was a bait and switch. And even if he had gotten something. So What if he'd gotten something that was bad news on Hillary Clinton and then turned it off over to the FBI? What then? Are we saying he shouldn't have done it? Or they're saying, if you've got that kind of info, turn it over. Well, as a matter of fact, that kind of info was turned over to the FBI. It's James Comey's press conference there back in July of last year. And then, of course, he said, oh, well, there's nothing to it.
But, Jeffrey,
the double standards here are amazing, not to mention this business with the Ukraine embassy trying to interfere in American elections on behalf of Hillary Clinton, as Politico wrote up in January. And suddenly now that's just not a big deal to people. But, isn't that a mystery?
But, Jeffrey, you originally said you've been involved in a lot of political campaigns, and you have. You're a veteran. Is it your opinion that both parties would take a meeting if they thought that information from a foreign government would enable them to get their candidate elected into office and probably not share that with anybody in the government?
Sure, absolutely. I mean, and while we're at it, let's think of all that Chinese money that went pouring into the Clinton campaign, the Bill Clinton campaign, in the 1990s. I mean, there you had money from a foreign entity coming into an American presidential campaign. You had, back in 1984, Ted Kennedy actively seeking to get cooperation from the KGB guy, who was Yuri Andropov, who was then the head of the Soviet Union. Nobody cares about this stuff, which is my point exactly when I say nobody cares about this stuff. It's mysterious that they don't care when Democrats are involved.
All right, but it's clear, Jeffrey Law, that the Washington Post and the New York Times are a tag team in attacking the Trump administration day by day, hour by hour. You can just see their drops. But the New York Post has been pretty protective and pretty supportive. What did you make that their editorial board, in their lead editorial today, said that Donald Trump Jr. is a complete idiot?
I saw it. I think it's just way overblown. I mean, I listened to Don last night, and I listened to him on Sean Hannity's show, and I understand exactly what he's talking about. I mean, first of all, let's just remember that unlike people like me, Don Trump Jr. has not spent his life in campaigns. He's been out there in the productive side of America, you know, making America great together with building the Trump Organization for his father. So he gets something like this in the rush and hurry of a presidential campaign from somebody that he, you know, has a passing acquaintance with. So he says, sure, okay, 20 minutes, great. Well, it turns out to be nothing and misrepresented. Now, in retrospect, with everything we know about the way what I call the old order is out to destroy his father, should he have thought, well, maybe this is a setup, which was possible? Perhaps. I mean, I think he himself feels he might have done it differently.
All right, but
did he do anything wrong?
Well, no. What I find implausible to believe is that every time anyone involved with the Trump campaign was asked about meeting with Russians, they seem to have collective amnesia.
But
have to be reminded about it. And then, oh, yeah, that's right. Oh, you know, I had so many meetings. How could you forget meeting with Russians?
Oh, my goodness, Curtis. I mean, in Washington, D.C., meeting with foreigners, ambassadors, embassy people, et cetera, is as common as meeting with actors in Los Angeles. They're everywhere. They're absolutely everywhere. When I was a mere staff member there, not just for a president, but a senator, I was hanging out with the German embassy and the French embassy and the British embassy. I mean, this kind of thing is regular to the point of monotony. You don't even think twice about it.
Right, but
you are constantly going to be approached by people,
Jeffrey,
good, bad, or indifferent.
He takes the meeting, Donald Trump Jr., and then asks Kushner, his brother-in-law, and Manafort, at the time campaign manager, to join him. So for 20 minutes, they're in Trump Tower. They're talking to this Russian lawyer.
Yeah, but did you hear the description from the Russian lawyer? That Kushner, that Jared Kushner, walked out after about 5 or 7 minutes.
Yeah, but
and that Manafort sat there staring at his iPhone.
Yeah, but
the whole time.
Right, but
that's not exactly.
But she also said that it was Donald Trump Jr. who kept pressing her. What dirt do you have on Hillary? Come on, bring it forward.
Well, I mean that is totally, totally common in any campaign. I mean, they have whole divisions of professional campaigns.
What I don't understand is a floor above them were the offices of then citizen Donald Trump. He hadn't yet won the Republican nomination. He was soon to get that in Cleveland, but they didn't tell him any of the three. I find that implausible.
No, Why? Why? I mean, this is minutiae in terms of the candidate himself. I mean, I had meetings with all kinds of people in the Reagan campaign. I didn't go, you know, say to somebody, well, I've got to talk to Governor Reagan or President Reagan.
I guarantee
Reagan
if, you were, meeting, if you were meeting with Russians, Reagan would have wanted to know.
Look, I remember meeting with one character who was, he was an American, but he was a, shall we say, less than sordid guy, as I eventually realized, from big labor. And he asked for a hotel meeting in a you know, a one-on-one situation. I told my boss, I went, I listened to the guy, I came back and said, you know, nothing good can come of this. Don't even go near it.
Well,
Ronald Reagan had no idea. Nobody would ever have dreamt of telling him this.
If you would have gone forward with that meeting, you would have knocked on the door, Jeffrey, and it would have been Svetlana butt naked saying, what would you like, Jeffrey? What can I do to satisfy you to bring you on board, huh?
And all I can tell you, Curtis, is the herd is on this. I mean, this is just another example of media overkill. And at the bottom line here is they don't have a thing.
Well,
they don't have it.
Let me tell you, Jeffrey Lord, who is the lone defender oftentimes of Donald Trump and his administration on CNN against a horde of Clintonistas, you are not going to ruin my day because, let me tell you something, if this is true, down below us, Carmelo Anthony, number 7, is packing his bags, the Chucker-in-Chief, and heading to Houston and the Rockets. Glory Holioski, hallelujah. I hate him. I despise him. I loathe Carmelo Anthony.
Curtis Sliwa, the deepest knowledge of the city.
He'll be the next mayor of the city of New York.
The Drive at 5, 77 WABC.
You can't start a fire. You can't start a fire without a spark. This gun's for hire.
5:26. Two related Shamuel Hefe Chris Christie stories. First, his lawyer in Bridgegate, Christopher Ray. He was up on the Hill looking for confirmation. We'll get that get to that momentarily. But also his friend in growing up, David Weilstein, was given probation for his cooperation in the prosecution of two of Chris Christie's minions who have been found guilty. On the line to discuss it, he followed each and every nitty-gritty detail of the trial is Bill Brennan, former Teaneck firefighter that also took Chris Christie to court. Thanks for joining us again here on the Drive Home at 5, Bill.
Happy to be here, Curtis. Happy to be here. I wish it was on. We had better news to discuss today, but it just seems like the system has gotten away from us.
Well, explain, David Weilstein, you follow the testimony. What was it that he said in court that probably should have led to an indictment of Chris Christie on the Bridgegate Lane closed matter?
Well, in a technical sense, he was indicted by a judge based on my charge because the judge found probable cause. But what he said was that on 9/11 of 2013, while he was at the World Trade Center site in the presence of Chris Christie and Bill Baroni, that they had a discussion, and they told Chris Christie that the lanes in the Fort Lee were closed, that it was a safety issue, and that nobody was returning the calls to the Fort Lee mayor, Sokolich. Now, at that point, Christie had a duty to order that the lanes be reopened, and he laughed, and he said, I'm sure that Wally Edge, and that was Wildstein's pseudonym, I'm sure that Wally Edge wouldn't be involved in anything political. And that there was evidence of official misconduct, as was confirmed by two judges on three occasions in Bergen County courts. The problem is that the county prosecutor and the state attorney general who worked for Chris Christie, rather than pursue a conviction, they made a motion to dismiss all the charges against him without doing any investigation.
Now, David Weilstein was a lifelong friend of Chris Christie, and yet, whenever he was asked, he acted like, well, yeah, he hung out in the crowd. I really didn't know him that well. He was tight with Christie, right?
Absolutely. They went to high school together. During Christie's tenure as the U.S. attorney, David Weilstein ran a political blog online called PoliticerNJ.com, and he never disclosed his identity. He hid under the name Wally Edge while he ran that site. And he only out, and by the way, and that site was the go-to spot for the U.S. attorney to leak stories. They always got, you know, he always fed David Weilstein exclusives from the Office of U.S. Attorney. And they were sort of using it like a propaganda mill to burnish Christie's reputation as a corruption fighter in his upcoming bid for governor. They worked in concert together to get Christie elected. So when, interestingly enough, when Wildstein sold Politiker NJ to go work at the Port Authority, do you know who he sold it to?
No.
Jared Kushner. That's who owns Politiker now. It goes under the term of the Observer. So Jared Kushner actually sent an email to David Wildstein telling David Wildstein, I think what you did up at the bridge was pretty badass.
But anyway, I want to flip to the confirmation hearings for potentially Christopher Wray to become the next FBI director, formerly a defense attorney for Chris Christie in the Bridgegate matter. In fact, listen to what Mike Kelly had to say in terms of what Christopher Wray did as his defense attorney.
One of the pieces of evidence that the federal prosecutors were not able to get their hands on when they were investigating the Bridgegate scandal here in New Jersey was Chris Christie's cell phone. And for a long time, this cell phone was missing. And then last summer, it was Christopher Wray who came forward as Chris Christie's attorney and said, I have the cell phone. I'm keeping it. So here's what we have. Here's what we have, Curtis. We have the new FBI director going in to being nominated by Donald Trump, Christopher Wray. But he's the guy who blocked FBI agents from getting their hands on that Chris Christie's cell phone.
Wow. Bill Brennan, not only did he keep the FBI from getting that phone, I know eventually when it was turned over, it was wiped clean, right?
No, it was never turned over.
Never.
The judge then, so much time had elapsed when they were all playing Mickey the Boob and they didn't know where the phone was. So much time had elapsed that by the time they made a motion to compel Wray to turn it over, the judge denied the motion. So they literally obstructed justice in the case of the United States of America versus Bill Baroni and Bridget Kelly. But I'm not sure how hard Paul Fishman worked to get that cell phone. And I have my own theory on what happened with this case. I think the entire litigation against Kelly and Baroni was set up to protect Chris Christie and David Sampson and Bill Stepien and all these people who have gone on, except for Christie, to bigger and better things. Remember, Bill Stepien was the most mentioned name during that trial, and he works at the White House now. He's the one that was having the affair with Bridget Kelly. David Sampson actually confessed to shaking down United Airlines for millions of dollars, and he got sentenced to go on vacation at his vacation home in North Carolina. And Chris Christie was never charged by anybody but me, even though there was substantial evidence that he committed official misconduct. I think the whole thing was designed to protect the powerful, and that they didn't want that phone because that phone would have put them in a position where they had no choice but to charge Chris Christie, not under the state law that I charged him with, but under the federal law of conspiracy and the other charges that Baroni and Kelly were convicted of. I think he was part of the conspiracy. I think Wildstein only let out that Christie knew about it because they were under the impression that that wasn't a crime.
Mm.
And when they realized that it was a crime under the state law, they closed ranks and everybody clammed up.
Well, appreciate that. That's Bill Brennan, who really pushed the envelope on this whole issue. But imagine Christopher Wray, who's up on the Hill being interviewed as a possible FBI director, obstructed the same FBI agents that he would be in charge of when he wouldn't give him Chris Christie's phone. How the hell can you become the FBI director after that?
The Drive at 5 with Curtis Sliwa.
Guardian Angel founder Curtis Sliwa.
Really try to help our cause.
WABCRadio.com.
Welcome back. Your dreams were your ticket out. Welcome back.
540. Whenever you hear that theme song from Welcome Back, Carter, and you think of the Sweat Hogs, you also think of a return to Brooklyn. A Brooklyn that many of you were born and raised in, you've since escaped, you come back from time to time, but your memories are still there, as they certainly are for me, because that's where I was born and raised for most of my life. And one of those traditions that you remember was the milkman delivering the milk in the morning, the newspaper boy throwing the daily news up on the stoop, and then all of a sudden, if you happen to be mostly Jewish families, very few Gentile families had this, but you would see the old timer, he would grab that 70-pound wooden case of heavy rattling seltzer bottles onto his shoulder, and he would schlep it either to the back porch or to the front area of a person's house and leave it there, or knock on the door and get paid for the delivery of the seltzer. And it was quite the tradition. And I remember seeing that occur over and over again. But that tradition faded, like so many other traditions have, from our early lives. And then there was the last man standing, Eli Miller, 84. For a half a century, he had been delivering the old fizzy seltzer that you used to get in that, what do I call it, a sort of bluish bottle, you know, with the spritz there, the whole nine yards, that you would use to make your chocolate egg creams, et cetera. And then he said he would have to hang it up. But to the rescue came Alex Gomberg, a young whippersnapper who decided, hey, I'm going to take your route. I'm not going to let this tradition die. And, in fact, Alex is joining us right here on the drive home at 5. Thanks. Thanks for jumping on board, Alex.
How you doing, Curtis? How you doing?
I've had better days, Alex, but this story brings me back to a better time in my life when I was a kid. And I used to see the seltzer man in my neighborhood of Canarsie, Brooklyn, and over in East Flatbush and East New York and Brownsville. Alex, how old are you?
I'm 29. I'll be 30 this summer.
So what motivated you to take over Eli Miller's route, one of the last seltzer delivery guys?
Well, it's a little family tradition for me. My great-grandfather was a seltzerman a long time ago. My grandfather was a seltzerman, we actually have the last seltzer siphon bottling shop in all of New York, one of three left in the country. And we, at Gomberg Seltzer Works, we fill the bottles for the last, you know, remaining seltzerman, which one of them was Eli Miller.
And if memory serves me correct, that's right in Canarsie, right?
That is in Canarsie, which I believe you are from.
Yeah, yeah. So now, how did you find out about Eli, and what prompted you to take over his route to keep the tradition alive?
Well, I graduated school about 5 years ago. I got my master's in higher education, and job market wasn't so great, but I saw an opportunity in my family business, which we filled seltzer bottles for these last remaining seltzermen. And my dad and my uncle, who have this bottling shop, were thinking of starting a route back up again, you know, for many, many years, but they just didn't have the time or energy to do it. So I'm young enough and stupid enough to take over this, to start this business, schlepping these heavy cases. And now we're delivering to many bars and restaurants and homes all throughout, many boroughs.
Now, I can go into any convenience store, bodega, and get a bottle of seltzer. How is your seltzer different than the bottle, store-bought seltzer?
Well, that's the key with our seltzer bottles. First of all, they're old-fashioned bottles. You're not going to get that in the store. They're very heavy, thick, hand-blown in Czechoslovakia bottles, but they have a metal top on it that has a valve. And that valve, when it's filled, it keeps the pressure at 60 pounds. In the store, when you get that plastic bottle and you turn the cap, you hear that all the fizz coming out right away. With our seltzer, the pressure remains constant. So when you push that lever, the seltzer dispenses, you have a very heavy, bubbly seltzer, whereas in the store, it's not going to remain, not going to have that same pressure.
So Brooklyn has changed enormously. A lot of families have moved out that had the tradition of the old seltzer man delivering. So you got a lot of folks like yourself, Alex Gomberg, hipsters, millennials, in your age range. How do you try to get them to all of a sudden sample what you're delivering? Because they're always into new experiences, finding out, you know, what used to be a part of the ambiance of Brooklyn.
Well, a lot of it's word of mouth, you know, just like it was back in the day. I mean, there was no internet and social media back then. So that's how we get a lot of, you know, our word out, and also a lot of media attention. People are always interested in, you know, the last remaining bottling shop, you know, left. But we target bars and restaurants all over, and, you know, people come into the bars and see the bottles and are very intrigued, and that's how we get a lot of the residential customers that we have, because they see the bottles in, you know, these upper, you know, upper class bars and restaurants, and then they take it for their home, and we deliver them to people's homes still.
Now, Alex Gomberg, as vice president at Brooklyn Seltzer Boys, how might people get in touch with you if they were interested in your old fashioned seltzer product?
So you could visit our website. It's BrooklynSeltzerBoys.com, or you could just call our office. The number is 718-649-0800. But every customer who, you know, passes through is going to speak to me personally. That's one of the biggest things, in the business, is the relationship that Seltzman has.
I'm going to do you a solid, Alex. I'm going to bust your stones and get you a double hernia. I'm going to make you schlep up those 70-pound wooden cases of your heavy, rattling seltzer bottles, 17 floors of Madison Square Garden, to deliver it here to the studios of WABC. You see what a class guy I am? You can't take the elevator, Alex. You got to do it the old-style way, the way Eli Miller, age 84, did until his last delivery on his day of retirement.
The Drive at 5 with Curtis Sliwa.
Those who practice like you.
Deep into the headlines. Deep into the streets.
This is good.
Deep into your eyeballs.
How disgusting.
Studio View is live right now. WABCRadio.com.
As we continue on the drive home at 5, this is part 2 of Gnome Laden's special editions about hookers from hell, those who can take you around the world in 80 seconds and expect to be compensated appropriately. The question is, our news director, Gnome Laden, who also hosts his own show 5 to 6, Monday through Fridays, right before Imus in the morning, how much research actually went into this project that involved his personal investment?
It's a 77 WABC News special report, legalizing prostitution.
In part one of this series on legalizing prostitution here in New York, we met Lucy, a local escort who works here in Midtown Manhattan. She's against the idea because, well, she doesn't want to pay taxes. Though she does admit legalizing prostitution might make it a whole lot less dangerous. In fact, she remembers a time where she had to fight off a client.
I am trained in jiu-jitsu. You know, as you know, jiu-jitsu is a submission sport. So I was able to knock, for lack of a better word, gentlemen out and then call the authorities.
The owner of the famed legal brothel in Nevada, the Bunny Ranch, Dennis Hoff, he says he sees lots of green in the Big Apple if he were able to convince local lawmakers why they should make it legal here in New York. His argument, for some, well, it's pretty convincing.
The federal government receives $6 billion a year now off of liquor. The prostitution industry in America is about an $18 billion business, and none of that money goes into the federal coffers or goes to pay taxes. With my plan, you'll be picking up another $6 billion in federal income tax from the girls. There'll be licensing fees of about $1.8 billion.
Yeah, but there's a lot of blowback to Hoff's plan. The stats that show the dark side of it all. The National Center for Missing and Exploited Children estimates that 100,000 children are victims of sex trafficking. The average age of entry into prostitution, just 13 years old. The city's Office of Child and Family Services in a recent study found 2,000 children were trafficked annually right here in the city. But Hoff claims the money made on men and women who want to work in the industry could be used to beat back against the dark side.
It's not going away. I spoke at Oxford University, and they have unbelievable sex trafficking all over the UK, just like we do here in America. Eliminate the sex trafficking, eliminate the disease, take the money out of the hands of the criminals.
The biggest roadblock to Hoff's grand plan, politicians, who he says behind closed doors love his idea but are too afraid to sell it to their constituents. In fact, he remembers one meeting with some congressmen and senators in D.C. at the National Press Club where he laid out his plan in detail, got lots of thumbs up, but found the fight for legalization went nowhere after that meeting.
We go right down the line and everybody's, yep, yep, yep. And I said, excuse me, Senator, would you be the first to stand up in front of your church group and say that you're pro the Bunny Ranch style of legal prostitution? And that the big laugh comes in because they're all hypocrites. All these politicians are hypocrites and they're liars.
There was one national politician who was willing to talk about legalizing prostitution, Gary Johnson, a one-time governor of Mexico. You might remember he ran as a libertarian for president in the 2016 race for the White House.
I've never engaged the services of a prostitute. I have no intention of doing so. But if you were to do so, where would you do that? Well, you'd do it in the only state where it was legal. You'd do that in Nevada, where you knew you wouldn't contract a sexual transmitted disease. But I leave that to the states.
When we called some local lawmakers, actually showed them a detailed plan to legalize the trade, some told us they thought the idea really had some merit, but said talking about it in public would spell the end of their careers. In part three of Legalizing Prostitution, we'll talk to an ex-prostitute who says it's a horrible idea. Noam Layden, 77 WABC News.
The plot thickens. Can't wait to hear part three of Noam Layden's series about hookers from hell tomorrow, right here on The Drive Home at 5.